It's even hard to say that in the same sentence, Huffman and Gall.
Good afternoon. We'll call to order the House Committee on Veteran Services and Emergency Preparedness, the date Thursday, April 25th. Thank you all. We have a resolution and then an informational session, an informational hearing with respect to the Republican caucus at 1:30, so and floor session at 2. So we can get all that done, I believe, and our intent will be to open up, of course, the public hearing on SCR 9, and we'll do that first, and then followed by, when we get the appropriate number, I anticipate a work session today as well, and then we can move to our informational hearing. So there's no surprises. That's our intent. That's what we'll do. With that, I'll open a public hearing on SCR 9. And Representative Reed, if you'd like, and Senator House, if you'd like to take the dais, and Ms. Edwards, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, SCR 9 memorializes Andrew Keller of Portland, Oregon. He was killed by insurgents in Afghanistan while leading his team in combat on August 15, 2012. He was posthumously awarded with the Bronze Star, Purple Heart, and Army Commendation Medal, and this resolution honors his service.
Thank you. Gentlemen, welcome, and I understand you both have committees and things going on, so thanks for taking time today.
Thank you, Chair Matthews and committee. Army Private First Class Andrew Keller was a son, a brother, a best friend, and a fiancé. He graduated from Southridge High School in 2008 after having been named captain and MVP of the football team, a team that won the Class 6A State High School Championship his senior year. He joined the U.S. Army on March 15, 2011, and soon after graduated to the top of his class from Airborne School. In July of 2012, he was deployed in Operation Enduring Freedom. Showing exemplary initiative and leadership, he was promoted to team leader within just a few weeks. On the 32nd day after his deployment, August 15, 2012, he was shot and killed by insurgents in Afghanistan during what was supposed to be a routine 48-hour mission to secure an observation spot. An estimated 800 friends, family, and members of the military filled the first floor seats of Sunset Presbyterian Church in Beaverton for his funeral a few weeks later. He was awarded a Bronze Star Medal, a Purple Heart, and an Army Commendation Medal for exceptional service and wounds received in action. Andrew Keller was fiercely loyal and kind. His friends talked about his athleticism, his giant hands, and his passion for life. Perhaps what got me most was something that someone said at the funeral. A classmate who was picked on in high school called Andrew Keller's father at the funeral and said after hearing the news, "I wanted to tell you, sir, I want you to know that your son was nice to me when nobody else was." So it's my hope that this committee will join the rest of us in the legislature in recognizing and honoring Andrew Keller for his outstanding service and sacrifice and extending our deepest sympathies to his family by passing SCR 9.
Thank you, Senator. And we'll save questions. Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, I'm Tobias Reed from Beaverton. I only want to add a couple of things to what Senator Hass already said. My first encounter with the Keller family was in 2007, my freshman session, when we were able to honor the Murray Hill Little League team that made it to the first Oregon team to make it to the Little League World Series in some time. Andrew's younger brother was part of that team, and they all came down for a ceremony, you may remember it. And they were a striking family, a really strong bonds and a clear dedication to the community. Senator Hass and I attended a Southridge game at which the school retired Andrew's jersey, and that impression that I had when they were here and the Capitol was really reinforced. I was struck when Senator Hass and I testified before the Senate committee that we both hit on that description that was offered about Andrew being nice to the kid who was picked on. I didn't hear it directly. It was also included in John Canzano's column about Andrew in the Oregonian. That's maybe one of the most striking things about him. Don't have the honor of the family's presence here today, but if the committee moves the memorial forward, they expect that they will join us on the floor, and we'll have a chance to honor Andrew and their sacrifice. So we hope you will move the resolution forward and appreciate your consideration of it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for that. Questions from the committee? I just think it's really important to sometimes take the uniform off the soldier as well and kind of talk about who they are in their community more than just their service. And we do a lot to recognize our veterans and their service, and we do a lot to keep the uniform on them from time to time. It's important to recognize them as the people they are beyond being a veteran and the good people they are. And in this case, an exceptional young man who's left this earth far too soon. And it is our intent to do that. I'm glad to hear. And I would assume that provided we're able to do so, which I don't see a problem, that you would be able to coordinate that with the family and try to make that work through the Speaker's office.
We will.
Thank you. And we are able to, well, would it be best to, I guess, is there anybody else who want to testify on SCR 9?
Say one thing.
Yes, Representative Escobar.
I thank you for bringing this forward. A mutual friend of mine and Senator Roblin, fellow that I went to school with, graduated out of high school with, his son was the first KIA in Afghanistan. And, you know, I just hope it's for not, you know, I hope they're not going there and sacrificing for nothing, which is my biggest fear in Afghanistan. Hope we get them out of there.
Thank you for that, Representative Escobar. And I myself am a former paratrooper. To come out number one in that class, you have to be an exceptional soldier. I mean, obviously, exceptional human being, exceptional soldier. And again, thank you both for your testimony. And with that, I will close a public hearing on SCR 9, and I will open a work session on SCR 9.
Chair Matthews, I move SCR 9 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Fagan moves SCR 9 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any further discussion? Seeing none, Ms. Craig, could you please call the roll?
Representative
Fagan? Aye.
Representative Escobar?
Aye.
Representative
Huffman? Aye.
Representative Witt?
Aye.
Vice Chair Fagan?
Aye.
Vice Chair Curtis?
Excused?
Chair Matthews?
Aye. Motion passes. SCR 9 is adopted. And Representative Reed, if you would do us the honor of carrying that and coordinating with the family, and appreciate both of you coming down to testify on this important resolution. Thank you so much. And thank you, committee. And we will reach out to make sure that Representative Parrish gets an opportunity to come down. I know she's tied up with some legislative business, but we'll try to get her down here and get her on the record for the vote. Thank you. And with that, we will be into an informational hearing, and we're going to have an update on the implementation of legislation promoting academic credit for veterans education and training. We have some folks that have traveled as far from the Central Oregon and also from Clackamas community, and we appreciate that, and have some folks stationed here in Salem, too. So do we have a list in an order that we'd like to go with here? We will open up our first panel. Let's have Chris Caldwell, please. And Alicia Moore, she is the Dean of Student and Enrollment Services at Central Oregon Community College. Welcome, ladies. Thank you so much. And as we discussed, we're here to accept at least till 2, but if it takes longer, I'll stay here for you and we'll get everything into the record. So thank you so much.
Well, I think we can be quick. I don't have much voice, so hopefully you can hear me okay. Chair Matthews and members of the committee, my name is Krissa Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. Just as a quick refresher, Senate Bill 275 in 2011 required development of standards for community colleges to give credit for education and training obtained while serving in the armed forces. We all agreed that to develop standards would be redundant because the ACE, the American Council on Education Guidelines, is the standard that's used universally in Oregon and across the nation. So what we agreed with you at the time was that what we needed was training to ensure that they're implemented and they're used universally across the state. So we did have that training last year. We invited the universities and private universities and colleges, and we had a packed house. It was a great training. We had a great trainer that came from ACE. So everybody has a push the refresh button on knowing how to actually award credit. Alicia is the one, this Alicia Moore, is the one that often is called on from other colleges when they have a problem, when they have troubleshooting, if they need additional training. So we asked Alicia to come talk a little bit about how it works.
Thank you, Krista. Chair Matthews and members of the committee, my name is Alicia Moore, and I'm the Dean of Student and Enrollment Services for Central Oregon Community College in Bend. Krista asked me to speak a little bit more what I'll call the nuts and bolts or operational side of how this process works. And because veterans have an option to let us know if they're a veteran or not, those that do, we automatically kick in a chain of communication or a process to make sure they get connected not only with their veterans' benefits, but they get their military transcript sent to us so that we can best award credit for that transcript. It works very similarly if you were to bring a transcript from another college or university, and we simply, most of the community colleges in the state, simply take a look at what the ACE credits are, the American Council on Education recommended credits, and award those credits as they go towards their degree. And it's a fairly straightforward process. ACE is an excellent organization, takes a lot of the guesswork out of it that we often have with colleges or universities, and literally is a credit-by-credit transfer in towards whatever the veteran has declared as their major. We, of course, make adjustments as if the veterans change their direction or change their major as they go, but it's a pretty cut-and-dry process. Are there other things you'd like me to touch on, Krista?
We'd be happy to answer questions. Happens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Several questions. Chris and I have talked about this over the last few years or so as we were working toward getting 275 passed and then implementation. What are the rules around, let's say I went to MP school. I was in the Army, so I went through basic training, so I've got, had the PT, I've got physical training, I've got some of the regular basic training schools, and then I my MOS was military police, 95 Bravo, so I went on to military police school. Spent a few years in the Army, got out, went back home, and got a job and worked for the next 7 or 8 years. Then got caught by the recession. I got laid off, and I was on unemployment for a few months and thought, boy, this is going nowhere. I'm not finding a job. So I go up to my community college, Columbia Gorge Community College, and I say, hey, I need help. Give me some counseling, some direction. So my military training would have been, say, at that point, at least 8 years old, and pick a number. I'm just trying to get to a point here with a long story about how does, was it ACE or PACE? I always have to ask you that.
ACE.
Because there's a PACE, too, and I don't remember what we deal with PACE in this building on. I think it's insurance or something. Mm-hmm. So does ACE determine how old that training can be before you give credit for it, or do you at some point have the veteran take a test to determine if that information would still be valid? How does that work in the real life?
Great question. Chair Matthews and Representative Huffman, the typical response is most community colleges do not, what I'll say, age out their credits. So if someone was in the service 20 years ago, those credits still apply. There are some technical degrees, especially in the health occupations, where there's an age limit to some of the technical requirements. Often that's imposed by some of the state licensure elements. And we do want our nurses, we want our medical assistants, our paramedics to have more recent information, but that's a fairly limited application of that. So in most situations, there is no age limit to those credits, so we're able to easily transfer those in to apply towards the service member's degree requirements.
Follow up?
Absolutely.
So I came in, and I've got my DD-214, and I've got my training certificates and all the schooling and everything. How do you start with me? I sit down and what could I look at getting college credit for? Would the PT, physical training and stuff, count? I mean, how do you start?
Sure. With the basic training, no matter what branch of the military a service member has served, basic training automatically comes in for various health requirements held by most of the institutions.
Now, wait a minute. So you're saying Navy gets the same as Army?
This superior, actually.
I'm sorry. Please continue.
Yes. that. So, for basic training, regardless of the branch, that does apply in that aspect. And then for at least at our institution, it works very similar to other institutions. We sit down with whatever declared major that service member wishes to pursue, and they can change their minds. They can change their minds the first week, the first quarter, sometime in the first year. We literally go through on the service member's military transcript. It's very straightforward and says, this type of education received while in the military translates to these credits and these courses. And we apply those specifically to the degree that service member is pursuing. So there's the generic piece with the health requirement due to basic training, and then there's the specialized piece as it's customized to each veteran and his or her degree requirements.
Follow up. So is there any way you can give us just a general idea of Joe veteran coming in of what kind of jump start they may be able to get?
Sure. You know, I brought a couple of samples of military, some students' transcripts with me to try and provide those examples, and it really does vary from degree to degree. If a veteran is coming in and going towards a general transfer degree, typically, off the top of my head, it's about 20 to 40 credits that we can transfer in towards that degree, almost up to half of that degree, depending on what courses they took while in the military. But everybody's training is so different, it's difficult to say. On the more technical programs like aviation or paramedic or structural fire or the health careers, things like that, those degrees are so highly prescribed, it really depends on what the veterans occupation was while they're in the military, as well as in what extra trainings, extra courses they took while they're in the military. Because those are so structured, oftentimes stored towards state licensure requirements, we have to tie those very, very tightly together.
Final question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, how are we doing around the state? Do we have a fully implemented program? Do we have veterans actually coming in and participating? Now, I know President Truesdell had a little bit of a jump start over some of the community colleges, but how are we doing around the state? Do we have a program?
Can you define program for me a little bit more?
We have services? Do we have veterans coming in, sitting down with advisors, and actually getting college credit today? Or do we have it implemented?
Absolutely. All 17 community colleges award credit for veterans' experience while they were in the military. In addition to that, we can provide some additional follow-up information, but all the community colleges are offering additional support services in some way, shape, or form at each of our institutions.
One final question, Mr. Chair.
Well, sure.
How are we coordinating with General Caldwell and folks that are coming back from deployment and with our county veteran services officers? How are we getting the word out to veterans that this is available to them?
Representative Matthews, Representative Huffman, that the veteran shows up at the community college and they have to self-disclose they are a veteran. When they come back from active duty, they do get information from the Department of Veterans Affairs. They get a CD with all kinds of information. After that, I believe they can't contact them. The veteran has to contact the agency. In the community colleges, it would be a variety of ways. If they're in the National Guard, then they would have contact with General Caldwell, and they do have education officers through the National Guard. Veteran service officers, because we had campus veteran service officers, I think that the county veteran service officers probably know more about the process and how to direct people, but I think it's mixed from community to community, and it's mixed how many veterans are asking for this service, for the guidelines to be used. But it is on the student. As Alicia said, they offer it. When they know there's a veteran student there, they offer it. So it's a communication process that it just happens. It's hard to say that it just happens, but it does. And veterans do know that this is available. If they're going to college, just intuitively they know, but they also are given information that shows that.
Thank you.
So they can't force
appreciate
them.
Appreciate your work on this because I was passionate about it. I felt like it was low-hanging fruit for our 40-40-20 goals and
yes,
and to get veterans, you know, some credit they've already worked on. Thank you.
Any further questions? Yeah, no, I appreciate the work as well. I've not, you know, when I came out of the military, I attended Mountain Hood Community College for a short while. Then I was offered my position as a police officer in a career and I left that college and have yet to return other than the EMT course and other things. I'm curious what it would be to go in there with the 214 and that experience, and that's something I anticipate doing. My question would be, so in your experience, and I really appreciate you making the drive today, and I'm just going to ask you, and I'll ask, this is for future panels too. Is there anything from our end, or on, from your perspective, that we could be doing on this end that would help you? You know, and trust me, if you say, yeah, stay out of our way, that's okay too. It's kind of a loaded question, but I'd like to hear your response if there's something that we could be doing that would get you the access, you know, to veterans or make it easier for them to come forward. I mean, we're doing a lot of outreach right now. Our effort is No Wrong Door, DMV, DHS, these agencies coming forward to, with the veterans' permission, you know, forward names to agencies so the agency could get them in touch with benefits. What do you, is there anything that you think that we could be looking at from our perspective? From your seat.
Sure. Chair Matthews, thank you for the question. There's a couple of different things. You know, at the federal level, there's a lot of things coming out of the Department of Defense and the Federal Veterans Affairs that are helping raise the awareness around veterans, and they're helping institutions, or actually helping the veterans better connect with institutions. So they do need to take that first step under some of the veterans requirements. So that's certainly been helpful for a lot of the colleges and universities and has gotten us more connected to our service members. And that's been a tremendous boon. Certainly the attention that your committee and past have done has helped in that regard. One of the elements that has been in the past in the state is the Campus Veteran Services Officers, or VSO position. And that position was a fantastic position. They were road warriors for sure. The person who served in Central Oregon had Treasure Valley Community College, Blue Mountain Community College, Eastern Oregon University, and Central Oregon Community College. So it's about a 10 to 15,000 square mile area that person had a representation for. But they were able to be on the campuses every other week or so, a certain number of days on each college or Oregon University System campus, and they were able to help connect veterans with all the other veterans benefits beyond the educational benefits that the campuses already provide, and to provide that cohesive, coordinated piece and advocate for the veterans with the different veteran benefits agencies was a fantastic service for our veterans. Many of those VSO officers also helped institutions create what we call boots to books transitions types of courses. Several campuses have stress management classes, veteran student success, veterans transition courses, thanks to the role that the VSOs helped play in creating those. So those positions were a huge help, and it's something I know institutions look forward to figuring out a way to recreate those even within their own structures in the future.
Great. Thank you. And yes.
So Chris, so let me get this correct. A little bit ago, you were saying that General Caldwell needs to do more. He snuck in when we were talking, so I just wanted to scare him there.
And the campus veteran service officer, certainly something we're on high alert for, county veteran service officers as well. We have a couple of bills that are sitting in Ways and Means right now. One in particular is on the veterans. It's a veteran lottery themed game, but it's really dedicated to a raffle. That would be generated about $1.3 million if that comes out of Ways and Means, which I understand it's gone to the subcommittee now. And has the greatest chance of doing so. Another one would be a veterans appropriation up from the lottery, specific to the need. And so I think that we understand that. And like I said, kind of a loaded question, but I appreciate your answer. We didn't talk about that beforehand, but that's kind of what I was hoping to hear, that any conduit that we could provide between the veteran and the institution would help us access greatly the benefits they've deserved. So thank you.
Thank you.
Anybody else have any questions for this panel? Thank you very much. And again, appreciate the drive and you being here today. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Next up on our second panel, we'll talk about the Veterpreneur Program. Joanne Truesdale, President of Clackamas Community College. Rob Campbell, Director of Small Business Development Center at Clackamas Community College. Welcome both of you, and thank you for being here today. And appreciate all that you do for veterans on the campus.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and Vice Chair from my district, members of the committee, it's wonderful to be here. If I may, I want to make sure that, Rob, I have a few comments to follow up on with Alicia, but I want to make sure that you all have an opportunity to hear about the small business development program that Rob is working in leadership with. In our community colleges, we often talk about teaching people how to learn how to learn, get a job, keep a job, or build your own job. And Rob is in the build your own job business. So with that, Rob Campbell.
Thank you, Joanne. Chairman Matthews, members of the committee. My name is Rob Campbell. I am the director of the Small Business Development Center at Clackamas Community College. I'm here today to talk about our veterans programs and our veteran and the program that we have for startup companies called Veteranpreneurship. Before I describe our veterans programs, I'd like to give a brief overview of our SBDC. As you may know, there are 19 small business development centers within the state. There are three in the Portland metropolitan area. We are the designated veterans SBDC. We receive referrals from Mount Hood Community College in Gresham and at PCC in Portland. Our county is kind of unique. We are very, we're a large county with a lot of rural area. There's about 16,000 businesses in Clackamas. Approximately 4,000 of those are people that are single owners working out of that third bedroom at their home. Out of the remaining 12,000, approximately 80% of those fall under the domain of the Small Business Development Center. At the college, we have another couple of departments called Customized Training and Workforce, and they actually serve the top 5% of the large companies that we have in the county. And we work together under the college's umbrella, what we call Center for Business and Industry. During the calendar year of 2012, our center provided services to approximately 1,300 clients. We held over 75 training events with 842 attendees. We provided 1,864 hours of no-cost counseling to our small business clients. We were responsible for creating 32 new business starts in 2012, and our goal for this year is 50. In 2012, we nominated Mr. Chip Sammons, who was the founder and owner of the Holistic Pet Center, to for an SBA award. It was a national award. It was the Small Business Person of the Year. And in your package, you have a copy of our newsletter, and you can turn it over. There's a picture of Mr. Sammons and the governor getting his award. This year, we have nominated Mr. Marshall Doyle, who's the owner of CalCert. And he is nominated for the 2013 award. Both of these gentlemen are veterans, and they are long-term clients of the Clackamas SBDC. To explain a little bit more about our veterans program, I'd like to explain my own story. In 2010, I attended a small business fair in the fall of 2010, and I was there to meet a friend of mine who was the keynote speaker, luncheon speaker. His name was Alan Zell, and if you've been around Portland, you know of Zell Brothers Jewelry. Alan is one of the nephews, and I've known Alan for a number of years, and I kind of lost contact with him, and I saw that he was the speaker, so I went down to the small business fair. I got there early, and I stumbled into a presentation called 10 Small Business Men by a guy named Dr. Thomas Jones. And during his presentation, he was talking about the work that he'd done over a 25-year period where he'd worked with over 2,000 businesses. 600 of them were startups with only 11 failures during that 25-year period. So after his presentation, I was very skeptical of his statistics, so I went up to introduce myself to ask him some more questions. Now, I found out that he was in Vietnam. He was in the 1st of the 12th. He carried a 60. I was in Vietnam. I was in the 101st Airborne, and then I got transferred to the 1st of 7th Cav. I carried a 60 most of the time I was there. So we had instant rapport. And he said, you know, we've got some money from the SBA for a veterans program. And he said, if you'd like to participate, we'll pay your tuition. Well, it was on Thursday nights, 3 hours a night, and I was watching Glee, you know, religiously. And so I wasn't really all that encouraged about attending this class. I've been to school and I've had extensive business experience, but they followed up with me and they kept after me, and so I did attend, and I found out that Thomas Jones was the real deal, and I really embraced his model. And I was very surprised that I'd lived in Portland since 1983 and I did not know about what a valuable resource this was to small business. So they hooked me, just kind of sucked me in. And what happened is that I went through the Small Business Management Program, and I attended the Veterans Entrepreneurship Program, what we call Greenhouse now. And I met the former director. His name was Tim Shea. And Tim had worked 20 years for the SBDC. And he decided to retire, and he encouraged me to become a part-time and adjunct faculty member there. And so I started teaching this greenhouse program. And then about a year ago, about 10 months ago specifically, I had a chance to interview for the director's job. And I guess the rest is history. One of the things that I think has made our college and our SBD successful was this pilot program that we kicked off in 2010. We had a 3-year grant from the SBA, and all of our grant money is administered through our SBDC network out of Lane Community College by Michael Lanoff and Mark Gregory. And because of this funding, we were able to offer lower cost tuition, and it's in my testimony. And our small business management classes, normal tuition is $695. Veterans pay $350. In greenhouse, it's $500, $495. They pay $150. So with these grants, we've been able to buy this, reduce their fees. This grant ran out December 31st, 2012. But with some lobbying efforts, we went back to the SBA and we got some additional funds for this year. So, but once those funds dry up at the end of this year, we would not be able to offer any reduced funding. I'd like to share with you briefly my experience as a student, as an instructor, and now as the director. Veterans programs are not Field of Dreams programs. You can't build them and expect people to just to show up. It takes time for people to re-entry. Depending on your MOS and how much action you've seen in the military, it takes time. And even though all the work that we do, we think we have a very positive contribution, unless you're giving away free money, it takes them a few years to re-enter. And unfortunately, both the Congress and state legislatures, you know, with well intentions, they provided all this money up front for this re-entry. But now, you know, the funds seem to be drying up a little bit when the re-entry is when it's really needed. I think one of the things that we have realized that we have built a foundation, because we work with all of the military support organizations, not only in Clackamas County, but throughout the state, and they help us get the word out to veterans. And so, Chair Matthews, I want to answer your questions. What can you do? One thing you could do is help increase funding or restore funding levels to the statewide SBDC network. And you could earmark funds for veterans. I think that would be good. I say that selfishly because I'm the veterans designated SBDC and I will get more funds for my programs. But the other thing that I would encourage is to create a statewide database of all the veterans that live here and work here. Like the state of Washington, I'll give you an example. The state of Washington has a B&O tax where if you have a business in the state of Washington, you have to pay 0.75% on all the revenues that you generate in Washington. They have a very extensive list of veteran-owned businesses. And I think one of the things that we need to do is, the best thing that we can do is help veterans-owned businesses, so veterans business owners become more viable so they can hire more vets. I think the second thing is to provide the services that we do in our veteranpreneurship program to help them start their own business. I appreciate the opportunity to testify in front of this group, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thanks for your work, and before I forget, thanks for your service.
You
we
too.
Always like to have our folks come forward and identify their branch and what they did. And as a 60 gunner, I can appreciate the load you carried. As an assistant gunner for a short part of my military times, that's a load as well. So good for you. Yeah, that ammo and tripod doesn't get any lighter these days. So thank you.
May I?
Yes, please.
Thank you, Chair Matthews and members of the committee. For the record, again, my name is Joanne Truesdell. I'm president of Clackamas Community College. And it's been a privilege over the last 7 years at our institution to really redevelop veteran services across not just the normal educational routine type activities, but also in the Small Business Development Center, our connection with the Army Strong Community Center, where we're serving families, and just a plug for Holistic Pets. Chip Sammons is also a veteran Air Force, and it was great to be able to see him in the spotlight with his Small Business Development Center. I love my SBDC director as he makes the appropriate pitch for his program. One of the things that I'd like the committee to be aware of is many of the institutions, all of our community colleges that are providing services to veterans as well as SBDC, contribute general fund money. And it's our community college support fund which funds that ability to have at least a decent level of tuition assistance and or reasonableness in terms of fees. So that's a point in mind. Also, I wanted to talk just briefly about our credential acceleration and support for employment. As a result of the information that Alicia provided regarding the ACE military, when we went out to do a national grant that was on credential acceleration support for employment, it involved all 17 community colleges, and it involved the entire spectrum of education. But one aspect of it that we focused in on was also veterans and continuing this good work. And so I just want to give you an update. The program, that particular initiative has been in place for 2 years, and the goal is to really tie all of the threads together in education, from Workforce Investment Act, which has priority veteran status, to the Oregon Employment Department, which has a veterans person to work through veterans, with the county VSO officers, which we are, just as a side note, very concerned about the lack of funding that counties are getting right now, and those VSO officers, well, I'd love to have them dedicated to education. We really need the breadth of service there. And really connect all those things together. So just as a point, we have not only are we working with the WorkSource Oregon and the Employment Department to identify and assist veterans who are not currently receiving benefits or accessing their benefits, so trying to get that reach out. We're participating in associations. Many of the Elks Clubs, Lions Clubs have also veterans clubs associated with them. We're getting our college staff throughout, out and about, in local hiring fairs, with industry and industry tours, and also regional veteran roundtables. The other piece is ensuring for example, the Air Force Academy that has an actual college of its own, ensuring that we're not missing that opportunity to connect with those Air Force or those other military academies and getting that credit in. So it's not just about your MOS or the training you received while you're doing that work, but it's also if you attended a non-commissioned officer training or any of those types of things. And at this point, what we have is we've served 160 new veterans throughout the state as a result of these combined efforts. This is a capacity building grant and some system change grants, and so our institutions are rethinking not only about how we serve many, but certainly how we connect all those dots for our veterans. And so with that, one last favor, as you are asking about what to do on behalf of our veterans. At the federal level, your advocacy with your local congressional person is very helpful. With military benefits, there is what's called no break pay. So when our institutions are not in session, our veterans are not getting paid their housing support or anything like that. And that used to be available to them, and it is no longer available to them. We have, as community colleges, gotten together to try to figure out how to, in that 1 week period, create a full-time status, how in a 4 week period to create a full-time status when that happens. It's just very difficult for veterans to maneuver through that and suddenly have no housing, no benefits, then suddenly benefits, and no benefits, and then benefits, especially with the time drag that occurs in just processing. So for me, that would be the one item. And thank you very much.
I appreciate that. Are there questions of the committee, of the panel? And there is a method to the madness for the question. You know, I mentioned the lottery bills, and basically there's going to be at least an initiative process outside the building taking place, if not already, to generate signatures trying to get a ballot initiative for a 5% lottery grab, which would be about $52 million. We had a bill in committee that we amended to a 1% grab from the lottery to dedicate to veterans, and that's about $10 million. But there was never really a plan coming forward with how we would spend that.
Oh.
So my goal, I think our goal, would be to get some comments on the record and also start working with ODBA and military department about what can we do for a plan so that if we end up with some successful initiative going forward to the voters to say, here's what we would like you to vote on, we can tell them what we're going to use it for. And I think education is definitely a peak of that. Reintegration, certainly. Mm-hmm. Small business aspect of it. Affordable housing. You know, I mean, the veterans' problems, there's not just one area that needs to be tweaked. The whole thing needs to be looked at. Mm-hmm. And I'm just very much aware that we have to be careful that we don't just think about these young kids coming home now. This is about all veterans.
Right.
And that's the great thing about, you know, your programs is there is just a very diverse range of veterans that are taking... not taking advantage, they're using their benefit that they've earned and taking advantage of an opportunity to enroll. So appreciate you being here and the testimony, and this will continue. This committee has been very passionate about these issues and how they transfer and how we can move forward from here and help our veterans continue to excel beyond their military service. So thank
you
so much.
We appreciate your support.
Absolutely.
And Representative Matthews, if there's something that we can do at Clackamas or I can do personally to help be part of that leveraging conversation, I'd be happy to participate.
Well, we will get a hold of the vice chair who happens to, as you know, represent you very
yes.
well.
So we appreciate
very good.
Support.
Thank you so much.
Thank
yes,
you.
She's wonderful. Thank you. And for the third panel, Bridget Burns, please. OUS. Ms. Burns, how are you today?
I'm great.
Wonderful.
How are you?
Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we apologize for the accelerated committee, given the floor session and everything, but perhaps we'll have enough time.
No worries. Chair Matthews, members of the committee, for the record, Bridget Burns, Chief of Staff for the Oregon University System, and I will be as brief as possible, just giving you a high-level flyover of House Bill 4059, which was passed last session, and what that bill did was it directed the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission to do a lot more work on credit for prior learning, which you've heard a little bit about, and what I'm going to do is summarize for you some of the work that's been done, mainly what OUS has done, and what we have learned as a result in terms of at the 100,000-foot level, what kinds of things do you need to know about how to think about CPL, how to make sure it works, and what kind of stuff we're doing. So first, I just want to let you know that I sent very recently, so you might not even have it yet, a few documents. I sent them to Elizabeth, so you have them. One of them is the Credit for Prior Learning Policy Framework, and this is going to be very helpful to you, and I'll explain exactly why. It's a big document, but just so you know, it provides a lot of information that will be summarized. What I can tell you about Credit for Prior Learning is that it's been around for quite some time, but it's really accelerated in attention in the last 5 years. A lot of that's because of the National Completion Agenda, because folks understand that this is a critical tool to achieving not just the 40-40-20, but the broader completion agenda nationally. What recently we saw a survey that indicated that 26.6% of Oregonians between ages 26 to 64 have some college, but no degree, which means a quarter of our population is out there, has demonstrated an interest for this learning and maybe has put in a lot of time, but didn't quite complete. And so what this does is it demonstrates for us that if we want to close that gap, CPL, Credit for Prior Learning, is going to be a tool to help us, a resource. So what I can tell you is that 4059 ordered the HEC to coordinate across all sectors to increase the amount and types of credit for prior learning awarded, increase the number of students receiving CPL, develop transparent policies and practices, create faculty and staff development tools, measure outcomes, and create articulation agreements. And what you can know about the Oregon University System is that while we are in the center of it all, we're not very top-down. We try and respect the culture and the history of each of our institutions. Many of them are at different places in the path on CPL. And what we've done thus far is an inventory of everything our institutions are doing. And we've also, what you'll see in this policy framework, we've done we've looked deeply into national best practices. Other states that are really hitting it out of the park, states that are not doing very well, where can we learn, where can we cheat and copy good ideas from other places? And understand that in the backdrop, what's different for us than community colleges is our accrediting body only allows us to use up to 25% of a student's degree credits can come from CPL. So knowing that it mainly can just close a gap, and we have so many returning veterans, we have so many non-traditional students, that CPL, credit for prior learning, is going to be a tool for us to be able to achieve the 40-40-20. So what we know is that it helps us achieve success. It increases the amount of success a student can achieve. It will increase their possibility of completing, and it will decrease costs. And those are all really important outcomes that we think will maximize the dollar per student and increase our ability to achieve our goals. So not just because it's a 40-40-20 metric or goal, or contributing factor to achieving that goal, but it's also something that we think is just a best practice for us to implement as institutions. What you need to think about from the high level as policy makers, when you think about credit for prior learning, the real key is assessment. How do you know that someone knows what they know? How do we come up with neutral and objective standards that really can be shared, where someone is treated fairly no matter where they go, depending on whatever their background was, and we give them appropriate credit? How do we make sure that that's something that really stands up to accreditation? Those are the things that we dove into. Second, what we've determined is really essential is consistent access to information. We have veterans who are coming all over. We have students, non-traditional students, as I mentioned earlier, coming from all over in different pockets of the state, making sure that they all have access to the same level of information and that it's consistent, that we don't change our tune based on where they sit. Additionally, I would tell you what the most essential thing is: advising. And this is something that is critical for all of our students. And what I would say, as you talk about low-hanging fruit, this is not really low-hanging fruit, but the real core of our institutions is about that stuff in there that's providing support, essential support services like advising to students. It's not usually the stuff that you get a lot of appropriation for, because in the past, where we get our money is based on enrollment. So it takes some institutions deciding that it's worth the cost to invest in advising. Portland State recently took a hit and hired a bunch of new advisors, and they saw their success rates go up dramatically in the first year. So what I would say would be most helpful here is additional financial support for student advising. And you, as you know, with the veteran service officers, that's really helpful on these campuses. We need to make sure that we're providing them with resources and support along the way. So OUS's role in all of this, in addition to compiling this information and looking at how each of our campuses are doing it and make a recommendation based on who's done it better and here's some stuff you could learn from, it's our job to monitor the success of CPL. It's our job to make sure that CPL credits are actually, if giving credit for prior learning is actually helping a student down the road when they're taking additional classes. And it's also important for us to make sure that quality learning is getting the credit it deserves. So what I can tell you about other states that have done it really well: Pennsylvania, Washington, Tennessee, Minnesota, and Wisconsin are all doing pretty well. And in terms of here in the state, our community colleges do an excellent job. They really got on the bandwagon much earlier than we did. And a lot of it is because of they are seen as such a resource center for these students. And we're trying to play a little bit of catch-up. We've learned a lot from what they're doing. But we also have articulation agreements with every community college and every one of our universities. So we know that we're going to be touching these students and helping them in the next chapter of their learning. In our system, Eastern Oregon University really has a phenomenal approach, which is an assessment model where they use somewhat of a portfolio approach to kind of gauging a student's knowledge. And then apparently Merrillhurst University also has a very successful model in terms of four-year institutions for credit for prior learning. So what I can tell you OUS has already done, and then I will tell you that there have been a number of groups that have been formed to continue to work on this, and I don't believe that the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission has brought its final report. I believe there has been a halfway report, but there will be a final report on this, because as you saw when I mentioned earlier, that bill, 4059, asked for a lot of things that there's no way you could do in all just 1 year. And might I add, the HEC doesn't really have staffing. What we did to demonstrate demonstrate our commitment to this is we actually hired someone to help provide staffing for the HEC because we thought this was such an important issue. And she can't be here today. Heather McCambly is her name. She's up in Portland. But we did think this was an important issue and we wanted to demonstrate our commitment. So first, we have contributed to the cross-sector work, gathering a bunch of data, which that's a really big piece here, is finding out what is everyone doing, who are we serving, how successful has it been, what do we know. We've also tried to work and formulate next steps for increasing access to credit for prior learning. We've convened a task force starting in November 2012. That task force is including members from all of our campuses, and that is going to be presenting a report in June to the Provost Council, which will make recommendations for all of our institutions. The HEC also appointed an ongoing advisory committee on CPL starting in December. They're going to spearhead a long-term development of resources and policies to expand quality CPL offering. And finally, the task force compiled a campus-by-campus inventory of CPL policies and practices. So what I can tell you in terms of this document that I sent forward, the policy learning framework, this gives you an understanding of the different ways that you should evaluate this policy outcome, CPL. It breaks it down. So first off, in establishing guiding principles, we have compiled all the national best practices for how you can do that, how people do that, what we've learned. And this way, we present it to our campuses and say, you know, you're going to come up with something that works for you, for your campus, but here are some things that we've learned from other campuses around the country. This seems to be the best approach. If you want folks to be able to get to the place that's going to work with the culture of their institution and the student profile that they're working with, it's providing them background, but ultimately allowing them to make the decision. What we're saying through this report is that it needs your policy needs to have components that are all composed within this. First, it has to have all the left-hand side, it has to establish guiding principles. You need to develop the types of assessment that are accepted. There are three different ways that you can assess thus far credit for prior learning. The first of which is you can do standardized testing. There's also been portfolio-based assessment. And then there's also institutionalized practices, which Eastern Oregon's practice is one of those examples. So figure out the type of assessment. We also indicate that you need to have clear standards for awarding the credit. And this asks all the very key questions. Enrollment, how long and how many credits? What types of credits? Is it only for undergrad? Could we potentially be talking about graduate credits? I mean, I think those are the questions we should be asking. The number, for us, 25% is the cap, or else it challenges our accreditation standards. But for each student, determining the appropriate amount for them is going to be important. Residency, do CPL credits count towards institutionalized residency requirements? And finally, the credit threshold. So that's, and what that does is it tells you, you know, what we've seen in other states that they've done that's been successful. This is the piece that I don't know a lot about what we're doing here in Oregon because we are currently asking a lot more questions about how we're going to structure our tuition for this. What the cost of tuition and how you want to structure associated fees for credit for prior learning depends on the institution. If you look at what I sent you, some states have very clear policies, like you can't charge more than half of the cost of tuition normal credits. Some of them, it's $25 per credit you're going to be tested for. It just depends. So finding out what works for the institution and understanding the institutional finances have a lot to do with it and how much demand they're anticipating having of students who are going to be needing these. So that gives you a clear understanding of who's doing what. The other question that really is always going to be present for us is transferability. Because if we give you CPL credits and they're not worth it for anyone else, if they're not going to be helpful to you to transfer to another institution, then we're not really setting you up for success. So what we do is we work very closely with our community college partners because we have strong agreements with them. But we're also trying to figure out within our institutions, how does this work? Our provost council are very important in that. And as I mentioned, they will be getting a finalized recommendation in June that will give them a clear policy recommendation for going forward. One thing I found that was interesting when looking into this is that some states actually charge for transcription, which is physically writing it on your transcript, the credits that you get. So that's an interesting choice that some states do. That's not our policy. We also give you an expansive assessment of all the different states that do transcription costing and how things will, how transferability would take place. The piece that is going to be most important for you all is going to be data collection and reporting. Because if we spend a lot of time and resources diving into credit for prior learning, but we can't prove to you it's actually contributing to success or it's improving outcomes, that's going to be problematic. So making sure that we have a full grasp of what students are coming in with and what we're going to be providing them and what their outcomes are down the road. And this is going to come within a larger framework because the Oregon Education Investment Board and ultimately the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission and OUS, all of us are all working together to develop a comprehensive P20 data system. And now you're going to see students who are coming in with military experience, and they're going to be getting credits that they're going to be part of that pipeline. So making sure it's all connected up is going to be important. Faculty and staff development, there's a lot of recommendations about how you can ensure that the personnel involved have the appropriate skills to be working with these students to really provide them with the resources and support that they need. Policy about transparency and accessibility. Again, these are all just requirements that we're saying you need to have when you do this. We're not going to be telling them exactly line by line everything they're going to do. Finally, we want to talk about the last two, are incentivizing CPL and policy review. And I think this is ultimately where the conversation is going to connect up with a lot of the broader higher ed conversations, is how do we make this worthwhile to institutions? Now, realize that how we are funded typically is based on enrollment. So if we're giving credit, but it's not going to be we're not going to be charging the amount that we would have if that person had been enrolled at our institution. What is the incentive for institutions? How do we set up a structure that makes it so that it's not just that it's beneficial for the institution and the student? We believe this is important no matter what. This is something our institutions have prioritized as something that is going to help us towards achievement, towards success, and towards achieving the 40-40-20. But I think that just in the broader context, understanding that resources are constrained, this we think to be successful requires a heavy degree of advising and support, and those things are typically not always prioritized in state funding. So any financial support you can provide is going to be very helpful, but ultimately this is something that we're committed to. You're going to hear a lot more in the future the more we know. This is really something that's somewhat new for OUS. The highlight for our system is present at Eastern Oregon University. They have the largest number of these students, but ultimately we're happy to be a resource on this subject and take direction from the Assembly in terms of what you would like to see us do next. Happy to answer any questions.
Well, thank you. Questions from the committee? I just appreciate your work, everybody's work on these issues. I know they're not easy to tackle. The document is on OLIS right now under the meeting material exhibit. So for those of you in the audience that are curious, it's on there. It's in its draft form. Not a final product yet, I'm assuming, correct? Or
The first one is, Chair Matthews, as I mentioned earlier, this is part of a year-long process.
Yeah.
And so... But, yeah, I actually think you can look at the policy framework and indicate that that's a pretty accurate assessment of what's going on elsewhere, unless other states change their practice. This will be an evolving document, but I think it's a really good baseline for us to think about how we dive into the subject and what other folks are doing as kind of our peripherals.
Well, and again, you will be, along with community colleges, part of the discussion as we move forward with Cameron Smith and others at ODVA to talk about what we would do if we were to, pardon the expression, but hit the lottery. And how some of those monies and dollars could be dedicated to the veterans. Your work with this committee on, veterans outreach and education, specific to grad students and whatnot has been significant, and I appreciate you on that. I do think, too, during that whole exchange, we learned that there's a lot of things we'd all like to do, but they all cost money. And so we have to be able to understand that we can't just keep absorbing a fiscal if it's associated with the benefit that we're trying to provide. And we have to find a way to make that happen. So that's all part of the ongoing dialogue. That's not going to get solved this session. But it is something that we'll continue to work forward on. And I would imagine that after the June dedication of all of this, the product, as you say, it's changing. It'll continue to change. We'll probably meet again in the interim and have similar discussions to find out just what's going on and how we're doing. And we'll know, too, by sine die on just if we are successful or not in pulling anything out of Ways and Means and getting a little further reach to helping our veterans. So, again, I appreciate everybody's testimony today, and thanks for being here for the information. But also, apologize for the expedited hearing. We have floor session at 2 o'clock, and if there's not anybody else that would like to speak on behalf of this informational hearing, we will adjourn the committee, House Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness. Thank you so much for your day. Enjoy your weekend, and we will see you next week. Thank you.